Chapter 3. The Affair of the Pink Pearl. "What on earth are you doing?" demanded Tuppence, as she entered the inner sanctum of the International Detective Agency, slogan, Blunt's Brilliant Detectives, and discovered her lord and master prone on the floor in a sea of books. Tommy struggled to his feet.
"I was trying to arrange these books on the top shelf of that cupboard," he complained, "and the damn chair gave way."
"What are they, anyway?" asked Tuppence, picking up a volume. "The Hound of the Baskervilles? Well, I wouldn't mind reading that again sometime."
"You see the idea," said Tommy, dusting himself with care. "Half hours with the great masters, that sort of thing. You see, Tuppence, I can't help feeling that we're more or less amateurs in this business. Of course, amateurs in one sense we cannot help being, but it would do no harm to acquire the technique, so to speak. These books are detective stories by the leading masters of the art. I intend to try different styles and compare results."
"Hmm," said Tuppence. "I often wonder how these detectives would have got on in real life." She picked up another volume. "You'll find difficulty in being a Thorndyke. You've no medical experience, and less legal. And I never heard that science was your strong point."
"Perhaps not," said Tommy. "But at any rate, I've bought a very good camera, and I shall photograph footprints and enlarge the negatives and all that sort of thing. Now, mon ami, use your little grey cells. What does this convey to you?" He pointed to the bottom shelf of the cupboard. On it lay a somewhat futuristic dressing gown, a Turkish slipper, and a violin.
"Obvious, my dear Watson," said Tuppence.
"Exactly," said Tommy. "The Sherlock Holmes touch." He took up the violin and drew the bow idly across the strings, causing Tuppence to give a wail of agony. At that moment the buzzer rang on the desk, a sign that a client had arrived in the outer office and was being held in parley by Albert, the office boy. Tommy hastily replaced the violin in the cupboard and kicked the books behind the desk.
"Not that there's any great hurry," he remarked. "Albert will be handing them out the stuff about my being engaged with Scotland Yard on the phone. Get into your office and start typing, Tuppence. It makes the office sound busy and active. No, on second thoughts, you shall be taking notes in shorthand for my dictation. Let's have a look before we get Albert to send the victim in."
They approached the peephole, which had been artistically contrived so as to command a view of the outer office. The client was a girl of about Tuppence's age, tall and dark, with a rather haggard face and scornful eyes.
"Clothes cheap and striking," remarked Tuppence. "Have her in, Tommy."
In another minute the girl was shaking hands with the celebrated Mr. Blunt, whilst Tuppence sat by with eyes demurely downcast and pad and pencil in hand.
"My confidential secretary, Miss Robinson," said Mr. Blunt with a wave of his hand. "You may speak freely before her."
Then he lay back for a minute, half closed his eyes, and remarked in a tired tone,
"You must find travelling in a bus very crowded at this time of day."
"I came in a taxi," said the girl.
"Oh," said Tommy, aggrieved. His eyes rested reproachfully on a blue bus ticket protruding from her glove.
The girl's eyes followed his glance, and she smiled and drew it out.
"Oh, you mean this. I picked it up on the pavement. A little neighbour of ours collects them."
Tuppence coughed, and Tommy threw a baleful glare at her.
We must get to business," he said briskly. "You are in need of our services, Miss...
Kingston Bruce is my name," said the girl. "We live at Wimbledon. Last night, a lady who is staying with us lost a valuable pink pearl. Mr. St. Vincent was also dining with us, and during dinner he happened to mention your firm. My mother sent me off to you this morning to ask if you would look into the matter for us."
The girl spoke sullenly, almost disagreeably. It was clear as daylight that she and her mother had not agreed over the matter. She was here under protest.
"I see," said Tommy, a little puzzled. "You have not called in the police?"
"No," said Mr. Kingston Bruce. "We haven't. It would be idiotic to call in the police and then find the silly thing had rolled under the fireplace, or something like that."
"Oh," said Tommy. "Then the jewel may only be lost, after all."
Miss Kingston Bruce shrugged her shoulders.
"People make such a fuss about things," she murmured.
Tommy cleared his throat.
"Of course," he said doubtfully. "I am extremely busy just now."
"I quite understand," said the girl, rising to her feet.
There was a quick gleam of satisfaction in her eyes, which Tuppence, for one, did not miss. "Nevertheless," continued Tommy, "I think I can manage to run down to Wimbledon. Will you give me the address, please?"
"The Laurels, Edgeworth Road."
"Make a note of it, please, Miss Robinson." Miss Kingston Bruce hesitated, then said rather ungraciously, "We'll expect you then. Good morning."
"Funny girl," said Tommy when she had left. "I couldn't quite make her out."
"I wonder if she stole the thing herself," remarked Tuppence meditatively. "Come on, Tommy, let's put away these books and take the car and go down there. By the way, who are you going to be? Sherlock Holmes still?"
"I think I need practice for that," said Tommy. "I came rather a cropper over that bus ticket, didn't I?"
"You did," said Tuppence. "If I were you, I shouldn't try too much on that girl. She's as sharp as a needle. She's unhappy, too, poor devil."
"Well, I suppose you know all about her already," said Tommy with sarcasm, "simply from looking at the shape of her nose."
"I'll tell you my idea of what we shall find at the Laurels," said Tuppence, quite unmoved. "A household of snobs, very keen to move in the best society. The father, if there is a father, is sure to have a military title. The girl falls in with their way of life and despises herself for doing so."
Tommy took a last look at the books now neatly arranged upon the shelf.
"I think," he said thoughtfully, "that I shall be Thorndyke today."
"I shouldn't have thought there was anything medico-legal about this case," remarked Tuppence.
"Perhaps not," said Tommy, "but I'm simply dying to use that new camera of mine. It's supposed to have the most marvellous lens that ever was or could be."
"I know those kind of lenses," said Tuppence. "By the time you've adjusted the shutter and stopped down and calculated the exposure and kept your eye on the spirit level, your brain gives out, and you yearn for the simple brownie. Only an unambitious soul is content with the simple brownie."
"Well, I bet I shall get better results with it than you will." Tommy ignored the challenge.
"I ought to have a smoker's companion," he said regretfully.
"I wonder where one buys them."
"There's always the patent corkscrew Aunt Araminta gave you last Christmas," said Tuppence helpfully.
"Oh, that's true," said Tommy. "A curious-looking engine of destruction, I thought it at the time, and rather a humorous present to get from a strictly teetotal aunt."
"I," said Tuppence, "shall be Polton." Tommy looked at her scornfully.
"Polton, indeed. You couldn't begin to do one of the things that he does."
"Yes, I can," said Tuppence. "I can rub my hands together when I'm pleased. That's quite enough to get on with. I hope you're going to take plaster casts of footprints."
Tommy was reduced to silence. Having collected the corkscrew, they went round to the garage, got out the car, and started for Wimbledon. The Laurels was a big house. It ran somewhat to gables and turrets, had an air of being very newly painted, and was surrounded with neat flower beds filled with scarlet geraniums. A tall man with a close-cropped white moustache and an exaggeratedly martial bearing opened the door before Tommy had time to ring.
"I've been looking out for you," he explained fussily. "Mr. Blunt, is it not? I'm Colonel Kingston Bruce. Will you come into my study?"
He led them into a small room at the back of the house.
"A young St. Vincent was telling me wonderful things about your firm. I've noticed your advertisements myself. This guaranteed 24-hour service of yours, marvellous notion, that's exactly what I need."
Inwardly anathematizing Tuppence for her irresponsibility in inventing this brilliant detail, Tommy replied,
"Just so, Colonel. The whole thing is most distressing, sir, most distressing."
"Perhaps you would kindly give me the facts," said Tommy with a hint of impatience.
"Certainly I will at once. We have at the present moment staying with us a very old and dear friend of ours, Lady Laura Barton, daughter of the late Earl of Carraway. The present Earl, her brother, made a striking speech in the House of Lords the other day. As I say, she is an old and dear friend of ours. Some American friends of mine, who've just come over, the Hamilton Betts, were most anxious to meet her. Well, nothing easier, I said. She is staying with me now, come down for the weekend. You know what Americans are about titles, Mr. Blunt.
And others besides Americans sometimes, Colonel Kingston Bruce."
"Alas, only too true, my dear sir. Nothing I hate more than a snob. Well, as I was saying, the Betts came down for the weekend. Last night, we were playing bridge at the time. The clasp of a pendant Mrs. Hamilton Betts was wearing broke. So she took it off and laid it down on a small table, meaning to take it upstairs with her when she went. This, however, she forgot to do.
I must explain, Mr. Blunt, that the pendant consisted of two small diamond wings and a big pink pearl, depending from them. The pendant was found this morning lying where Mrs. Betts had left it, but the pearl, a pearl of enormous value, had been wrenched off.
Who found the pendant?
The parlourmaid, Gladys Hill.
Any reason to suspect her?
Well, she's been with us some years, and we've always found her perfectly honest, but of course one never knows.
Exactly. Will you describe your staff, and also tell me who was present at dinner last night?
There's the cook. She's been with us only 2 months, but then she would have no occasion to go near the drawing-room. The same applies to the kitchen-maid. Then there is the housemaid, Alice Cummings. She also has been with us for some years. And Lady Laura's maid, of course. She is French.
Colonel Kingston Bruce looked very impressive as he said this. Tommy, unaffected by the revelation of the maid's nationality, said,
"Exactly."
And the party at dinner?
Mr. and Mrs. Betts, ourselves, my wife and daughter, and Lady Laura. Young St. Vincent was dining with us, and Mr. Rennie looked in after dinner for a while.
Who is Mr. Rennie?
A most pestilential fellow, an arrant socialist. Good-looking, of course, and with a certain specious power of argument, but a man, I don't mind telling you, whom I wouldn't trust a yard. A dangerous sort of fellow.
In fact, said Tommy dryly, it is Mr. Rennie whom you suspect.
I do, Mr. Blunt. I'm sure, holding the views he does, that he can have no principles whatsoever. What could have been easier for him than to have quietly wrenched off the pearl at a moment when we were all absorbed in our game? There were several absorbing moments. A redoubled no-trump hand, I remember, and also a painful argument when my wife had the misfortune to revoke.
Quite so, said Tommy. I should just like to know one thing. What is Mrs. Betts' attitude in all this?
Oh, she wanted me to call in the police, said Colonel Kingston Bruce reluctantly. That is, when we had searched everywhere in case the pearl had only dropped off.
But you dissuaded her.
Well, I was very averse to the idea of publicity, and my wife and daughter backed me up. Then my wife remembered young St. Vincent speaking about your firm at dinner last night, and the 24-hour special service.
Yes, said Tommy with a heavy heart.
You see, in any case, no harm will be done. If we call in the police tomorrow, it can be supposed that we thought the jewel merely lost and were hunting for it. By the way, nobody has been allowed to leave the house this morning.
Except your daughter, of course, said Tuppence, speaking for the first time.
Except my daughter, agreed the colonel. She volunteered at once to go and put the case before you.
Tommy rose.
We will do our best to give you satisfaction, colonel, he said. I should like to see the drawing-room and the table on which the pendant was laid down. I should also like to ask Mrs. Betts a few questions. After that, I will interview the servants, or rather, my assistant, Miss Robinson, will do so.
He felt his nerve quailing before the terrors of questioning the servants. Colonel Kingston Bruce threw open the door and led them across the hall. As he did so, a remark came to them clearly through the open door of the room they were approaching, and the voice that uttered it was that of the girl who had come to see them that morning.
"You know perfectly well, Mother," she was saying, "that she did bring home a teaspoon in her muff."
In another minute they were being introduced to Mrs. Kingston Bruce, a plaintive lady with a languid manner. Miss Kingston Bruce acknowledged their presence with a short inclination of the head. Her face was more sullen than ever. Mrs. Kingston Bruce was voluble.
"But I know who I think took it," she ended. "That dreadful socialist young man. He loves the Russians and the Germans and hates the English. What else can you expect?"
"He never touched it," said Miss Kingston Bruce fiercely. "I was watching him, all the time. I couldn't have failed to see if he had."
She looked at them defiantly with her chin up. Tommy created a diversion by asking for an interview with Mrs. Betts. When Mrs. Kingston Bruce had departed, accompanied by her husband and daughter to find Mrs. Betts, he whistled thoughtfully.
"I wonder," he said gently, "who it was who had a teaspoon in her muff."
"Just what I was thinking," replied Tuppence.
Mrs. Betts, followed by her husband, burst into the room. She was a big woman with a determined voice. Mr. Hamilton Betts looked dyspeptic and subdued.
I understand, Mr. Blunt, that you are a private inquiry agent, and one who hustles things through at a great rate.
Hustle, said Tommy, is my middle name, Mrs. Betts. Let me ask you a few questions. Thereafter, things proceeded rapidly. Tommy was shown the damaged pendant, the table on which it had lain, and Mr. Betts emerged from his taciturnity to mention the value, in dollars, of the stolen pearl. And withal, Tommy felt an irritating certainty that he was not getting on.
"I think that will do," he said at length. "Miss Robinson, will you kindly fetch the special photographic apparatus from the hall?"
Miss Robinson complied.
"A little invention of my own," said Tommy. "In appearance, you see, it's just like an ordinary camera."
He had some slight satisfaction in seeing that the Betts were impressed. He photographed the pendant, the table on which it had lain, and took several general views of the apartment. Then Miss Robinson was delegated to interview the servants, and in view of the eager expectancy on the faces of Colonel Kingston Bruce and Mrs. Betts, Tommy felt called upon to say a few authoritative words.
"The position amounts to this," he said. "Either the pearl is still in the house, or it is not still in the house."
"Quite so,"
said the Colonel, with more respect than was perhaps quite justified by the nature of the remark.
"If it is not in the house, it may be anywhere. But if it is in the house, it must necessarily be concealed somewhere."
"And a search must be made," broke in Colonel Kingston Bruce.
"Quite so.
I give you carte blanche, Mr. Blunt. Search the house from attic to cellar."
"Oh, Charles," murmured Mrs. Kingston Bruce tearfully, "do you think that is wise? The servants won't like it. I'm sure they'll leave."
"We will search their quarters last," said Tommy soothingly. "The thief is sure to have hidden the gem in the most unlikely place."
"I seem to have read something of the kind," agreed the Colonel.
"Quite so," said Tommy.
"You probably remember the case of Rex v. Bailey, which created a precedent."
Oh, yes,
said the Colonel, looking puzzled. "Now, the most unlikely place is in the apartment of Mrs. Betts," continued Tommy.
"My, wouldn't that be too cute?" said Mrs. Betts admiringly.
Without more ado, she took him up to her room, where Tommy once more made use of the special photographic apparatus. Presently, Tuppence joined him there.
You have no objection, I hope, Mrs. Betts, to my assistance looking through your wardrobe?"
"Why, not at all. Do you need me here any longer?"
Tommy assured her that there was no need to detain her, and Mrs. Betts departed.
"We might as well go on bluffing it out," said Tommy. "But personally, I don't believe we've got a dog's chance of finding the thing."
"Curse you and your 24 hours stunt, Tuppence."
"Listen," said Tuppence. "The servants are all right, I'm sure, but I managed to get something out of the French maid. It seems that when Lady Laura was staying here a year ago, she went out to tea with some friends of the Kingston Bruces, and when she got home, a teaspoon fell out of her muff. Everyone thought it must have fallen in by accident, but by talking about similar robberies, I got hold of a lot more. Lady Laura is always staying about with people. She hasn't got a bean, I gather, and she's out for comfortable quarters with people to whom a title still means something. It may be a coincidence, or it may be something more, but 5 distinct thefts have taken place whilst she has been staying in various houses, sometimes trivial things, sometimes valuable jewels."
"Phew," said Tommy, and gave vent to a prolonged whistle.
"Where's the old bird's room, do you know?"
"Just across the passage."
"Then I rather think that we'll just slip across and investigate."
The room opposite stood with its door ajar. It was a spacious apartment, with white enameled fitments and rose-pink curtains. An inner door led to a bathroom. At the door of this appeared a slim, dark girl, very neatly dressed. Tuppence checked the exclamation of astonishment on the girl's lips.
"This is Elise, Mr. Blunt," she said primly. "Lady Laura's maid."
Tommy stepped across the threshold of the bathroom and approved inwardly its sumptuous and up-to-date fittings. He set to work to dispel the wide stare of suspicion on the French girl's face.
"You are busy with your duties, eh, Mademoiselle Elise?"
"Yes, monsieur. I clean my lady's bath."
"Well, perhaps you'll help me with some photography instead. I have a special kind of camera here, and I am photographing the interiors of all the rooms in this house."
He was interrupted by the communicating door to the bedroom banging suddenly behind him. Elise jumped at the sound.
What did that?
It must have been the wind, said Tuppence.
We will come into the other room, said Tommy. Elise went to open the door for them, but the doorknob rattled aimlessly. What's the matter? Said Tommy sharply.
Ah, monsieur, but somebody must have locked it on the other side.
She caught up a towel and tried again. But this time the door handle turned easily enough, and the door swung open.
Voilà, ce qui est curieux. It must have been stuck, said Elise.
There was no one in the bedroom. Tommy fetched his apparatus. Tuppence and Elise worked under his orders, but again and again his glance went back to the communicating door.
I wonder, he said between his teeth, I wonder why that door stuck.
He examined it minutely, shutting and opening it. It fitted perfectly. One picture more, he said with a sigh. Will you loop back that rose curtain, Mademoiselle Elise? Thank you. Just hold it so. The familiar click occurred. He handed a glass slide to Elise to hold, relinquished the tripod to Tuppence, and carefully readjusted and closed the camera. He made some easy excuse to get rid of Elise, and as soon as she was out of the room, he caught hold of Tuppence and spoke rapidly. Look here, I've got an idea. Can you hang on here? Search all the rooms. That will take some time. Try and get an interview with the old bird, Lady Laura, but don't alarm her. Tell her you suspect the parlourmaid, but whatever you do, don't let her leave the house. I'm going off in the car. I'll be back as soon as I can.
All right, said Tuppence, but don't be too cocksure. You've forgotten one thing. The girl. There's something funny about that girl. Listen, I've found out the time she started from the house this morning. It took her 2 hours to get to our office. Well, that's nonsense. Where did she go before she came to us?
There's something in that, admitted her husband.
Well, follow up any old clue you like, but don't let Lady Laura leave the house.
What's that? His quick ear had caught a faint rustle outside on the landing. He strode across to the door, but there was no one to be seen.
Well, so long, he said. I'll be back as soon as I can.
Tuppence watched him drive off in the car with a faint misgiving. Tommy was very sure. She herself was not so sure. There were one or two things she did not quite understand. She was still standing by the window, watching the road, when she saw a man leave the shelter of a gateway opposite, cross the road, and ring the bell. In a flash, Tuppence was out of the room and down the stairs. Gladys Hill, the parlourmaid, was emerging from the back part of the house, but Tuppence motioned her back authoritatively. Then she went to the front door and opened it. A lanky young man with ill-fitting clothes and eager dark eyes was standing on the step. He hesitated a moment and then said,
Is Miss Kingston Bruce in?
Will you come inside? Said Tuppence.
She stood aside to let him enter, closing the door.
Mr. Rennie, I think, she said sweetly.
He shot a quick glance at her.
Yes.
Will you come in here, please?
She opened the study door. The room was empty, and Tuppence entered it after him, closing the door behind her. He turned on her with a frown.
I want to see Miss Kingston Bruce.
I'm not quite sure that you can, said Tuppence composedly.
Look here, who the devil are you? Said Mr. Rennie rudely.
International Detective Agency, said Tuppence succinctly,
and noticed Mr. Rennie's uncontrollable start.
Please sit down, Mr. Rennie, she went on. To begin with, we know all about Miss Kingston Bruce's visit to you this morning.
It was a bold guess, but it succeeded. Perceiving his consternation, Tuppence went on quickly.
The recovery of the pearl is the great thing, Mr. Rennie. No one in this house is anxious for publicity. Can't we come to some arrangement?
The young man looked at her keenly.
I wonder how much you know, he said thoughtfully. Let me think for a moment.
He buried his head in his hands, then asked a most unexpected question.
I say, is it really true that young St. Vincent is engaged to be married?
Quite true, said Tuppence. I know the girl.
Mr. Rennie suddenly became confidential.
It's been hell, he confided. They've been asking her morning, noon, and night, chucking Beatrice at his head. And all because he'll come into a title some day. If I had my way...
Don't let's talk politics, said Tuppence hastily. Do you mind telling me, Mr. Rennie, why you think Miss Kingston Bruce took the pearl?
I I don't.
You do, said Tuppence calmly. You wait to see the detective, as you think, drive off, and the coast clear, and then you come and ask for her. It's obvious. If you'd taken the pearl yourself, you wouldn't be half so upset.
Her manner was so odd, said the young man. She came this morning and told me about the robbery, explaining that she was on her way to a firm of private detectives. She seemed anxious to say something, and yet not able to get it out.
Well, said Tuppence, all I want is the pearl. You'd better go and talk to her. But at that moment, Colonel Kingston Bruce opened the door.
A lunch is ready, Miss Robinson. You will lunch with us, I hope.
Then he stopped and glared at the guest.
Clearly, said Mr. Rennie, you don't want to ask me to lunch. All right, I'll go.
Come back later, whispered Tuppence as he passed her. Tuppence followed Colonel Kingston Bruce, still growling into his moustache about the pestilential impudence of some people, into a massive dining room where the family was already assembled. Only one person present was unknown to Tuppence.
This, Lady Laura, is Miss Robinson, who is kindly assisting us.
Lady Laura bent her head, and then proceeded to stare at Tuppence through her pince-nez. She was a tall, thin woman, with a sad smile, a gentle voice, and very hard, shrewd eyes. Tuppence returned her stare, and Lady Laura's eyes dropped. After lunch, Lady Laura entered into conversation with an air of gentle curiosity. How was the inquiry proceeding? Tuppence laid suitable stress on the suspicion attaching to the parlourmaid, but her mind was not really on Lady Laura. Lady Laura might conceal teaspoons and other articles in her clothing, but Tuppence felt fairly sure that she had not taken the pink pearl. Presently, Tuppence proceeded with her search of the house. Time was going on. There was no sign of Tommy, and, what mattered far more to Tuppence, there was no sign of Mr. Rennie. Suddenly, Tuppence came out of a bedroom and collided with Beatrice Kingston Bruce, who was going downstairs. She was fully dressed for the street.
I'm afraid, said Tuppence, that you mustn't go out just now.
The other girl looked at her haughtily.
Whether I go out or not is no business of yours, she said coldly.
It is my business whether I communicate with the police or not, though, said Tuppence. In a minute the girl had turned ashy pale.
You mustn't. You mustn't. I won't go out, but don't do that.
She clung to Tuppence beseechingly. My dear Miss Kingston Bruce, said Tuppence, smiling, the case has been perfectly clear to me from the start. But she was interrupted. In the stress of her encounter with the girl, Tuppence had not heard the front door bell. Now, to her astonishment, Tommy came bounding up the stairs, and in the hall below she caught sight of a big, burly man in the act of removing a bowler hat.
Detective Inspector Marriott of Scotland Yard, said Tommy with a grin.
With a cry, Beatrice Kingston Bruce tore herself from Tuppence's grasp and dashed down the stairs just as the front door was opened once more to admit Mr. Rennie.
Now you have torn it, said Tuppence bitterly.
Eh? Said Tommy, hurrying into Lady Laura's room.
He passed on into the bathroom and picked up a large cake of soap, which he brought out in his hands. The inspector was just mounting the stairs.
She went quite quietly, he announced. She's an old hand and knows when the game is up. What about the pearl?
I rather fancy, said Tommy, handing him the soap, that you'll find it in here. The inspector's eyes lit up appreciatively.
An old trick and a good one. Cut a cake of soap in half, scoop out a place for the jewel, clap it together again, and smooth the join well over with hot water. A very smart piece of work on your part, sir.
Tommy accepted the compliment gracefully. He and Tuppence descended the stairs. Colonel Kingston Bruce rushed at him and shook him warmly by the hand.
My dear sir, I can't thank you enough. Lady Laura wants to thank you also.
I'm glad we've given you satisfaction, said Tommy. But I'm afraid I can't stop. I have a most urgent appointment. Member of the Cabinet. He hurried out to the car and jumped in. Tuppence jumped in beside him.
But Tommy, she cried, haven't they arrested Lady Laura after all?
Oh, said Tommy, didn't I tell you?
They've not arrested Lady Laura. They've arrested Elise. You see, he went on as Tuppence sat dumbfounded, I've often tried to open a door with soap on my hands myself. It can't be done. Your hands slip.
so I wondered what Elise could have been doing with the soap to get her hands as soapy as all that. She caught up a towel, you remember, so there were no traces of soap on the handle afterwards. But it occurred to me that if you were a professional thief, it wouldn't be a bad plan to be a maid to a lady suspected of kleptomania, who stayed about a good deal in different houses. So I managed to get a photo of her as well as of the room, induced her to handle a glass slide, and toddled off to dear old Scotland Yard. Lightning development of negative, successful identification of fingerprints, and photo. Elise was a long-lost friend. Useful place, Scotland Yard. And to think, said Tuppence, finding her voice, that those two young idiots were only suspecting each other in that weak way that they do in books. But why didn't you tell me what you were up to when you went off? In the first place, I suspected that Elise was listening on the landing, and in the second place... Yes? My learned friend forgets, said Tommy. Thorndyke never tells until the last moment. Besides, Tuppence, you and your pal Janet Smith put one over on me last time. This makes us all square. Chapter 4 The Adventure of the Sinister Stranger.
It's been a darn dull day, said Tommy, and yawned widely.
Nearly tea time, said Tuppence, and also yawned.
Business was not brisk in the International Detective Agency. The eagerly expected letter from the ham merchant had not arrived, and bona fide cases were not forthcoming. Albert, the office boy, entered with a sealed package, which he laid on the table.
The mystery of the sealed packet, murmured Tommy. Did it contain the fabulous pearls of the Russian Grand Duchess, or was it an infernal machine destined to blow Blunt's brilliant detectives to pieces?
As a matter of fact, said Tuppence, tearing open the package, it's my wedding present to Francis Haviland. Rather nice, isn't it? Tommy took a slender silver cigarette case from her outstretched hand, noted the inscription engraved in her own handwriting, Francis from Tuppence, opened and shut the case, and nodded approvingly.
You do throw your money about, Tuppence, he remarked. I'll have one like it, only in gold for my birthday next month.
Fancy wasting a thing like that on Francis Haviland, who always was, and always will be, one of the most perfect asses God ever made.
You forget I used to drive him about during the war when he was a general.
Ah, those were the good old days.
They were, agreed Tommy.
Beautiful women used to come and squeeze my hand in hospital, I remember, but I don't send them all wedding presents. I don't believe the bride will care much for this gift of yours, Tuppence.
It's nice and slim for the pocket, isn't it? Said Tuppence, disregarding his remarks.
Tommy slipped it into his own pocket.
Just right, he said approvingly. Hello, here is Albert with the afternoon post. Very possibly the Duchess of Perthshire is commissioning us to find her prize peak.
They sorted through the letters together. Suddenly, Tommy gave vent to a prolonged whistle and held up one of them in his hand. A blue letter, with a Russian stamp on it. Do you remember what the chief said? We were to look out for letters like that.
How exciting, said Tuppence. Something has happened at last. Open it and see if the contents are up to schedule. A ham merchant, wasn't it? Half a minute. We shall want some milk for tea. They forgot to leave it this morning. I'll send Albert out for it.
She returned from the outer office after dispatching Albert on his errand to find Tommy holding the blue sheet of paper in his hand.
As we thought, Tuppence, he remarked, almost word for word what the chief said.
Tuppence took the letter from him and read it. It was couched in careful, stilted English, and purported to be from one Gregor Feodorsky, who was anxious for news of his wife. The International Detective Agency was urged to spare no expense in doing their utmost to trace her. Feodorsky himself was unable to leave Russia at the moment, owing to a crisis in the pork trade.
I wonder what it really means, said Tuppence thoughtfully, smoothing out the sheet of paper on the table in front of her.
Well, code of some kind, I suppose, said Tommy. That's not our business. Our business is to hand it over to the chief as soon as possible. Better just verify it by soaking off the stamp and seeing if the number 16 is underneath.
All right, said Tuppence, but I should think...
She stopped dead,
and Tommy, surprised by her sudden pause, looked up to see a man's burly figure blocking the doorway. The intruder was a man of commanding presence, squarely built, with a very round head and a powerful jaw. He might have been about 45 years of age.
"I must beg your pardon," said the stranger, advancing into the room, hat in hand. "I found your outer office empty and this door open, so I ventured to intrude. This is Blunt's International Detective Agency, is it not?"
"Certainly it is."
"And you are, perhaps, Mr. Blunt? Mr. Theodore Blunt?"
"I am, Mr. Blunt. You wish to consult me? This is my secretary, Miss Robinson." Tuppence inclined her head gracefully, but continued to scrutinize the stranger narrowly through her downcast eyelashes. She was wondering how long he had been standing in the doorway, and how much he had seen and heard. It did not escape her observation that even while he was speaking to Tommy, his eyes kept coming back to the blue paper in her hand. Tommy's voice, sharp with a warning note, recalled her to the needs of the moment.
"Miss Robinson, please, take notes."
"Now, sir, will you kindly state the matter on which you wish to have my advice?" Tuppence reached for her pad and pencil. The big man began in a rather harsh voice.
"My name is Bauer, Dr. Charles Bauer. I live in Hampstead, where I have a practice. I have come to you, Mr. Blunt, because several rather strange occurrences have happened lately."
"Yes, Dr. Bauer?"
"Twice in the course of the last week, I have been summoned by telephone to an urgent case. In each case, to find that the summons has been a fake. The first time, I thought a practical joke had been played upon me, but on my return the second time, I found that some of my private papers had been displaced and disarranged, and now I believe that the same thing had happened the first time. I made an exhaustive search and came to the conclusion that my whole desk had been thoroughly ransacked, and the various papers replaced hurriedly."
Dr. Bauer paused and gazed at Tommy.
"Well, Mr. Blunt?"
"Well, Dr. Bauer," replied the young man, smiling.
"What do you think of it, eh?"
"Well, first I should like the facts. What do you keep in your desk?"
"My private papers."
"Exactly. Now, what do those private papers consist of? What value are they to the common thief, or any particular person?"
"To the common thief, I cannot see that they would have any value at all. But my notes on certain obscure alkaloids would be of interest to anyone possessed of technical knowledge of the subject. I have been making a study of such matters for the last few years. These alkaloids are deadly and virulent poisons, and are in addition almost untraceable. They yield no known reactions."
"The secret of them would be worth money, then?"
"To unscrupulous persons, yes."
"And you suspect whom?"
The doctor shrugged his massive shoulders. "As far as I can tell, the house was not entered forcibly from the outside. That seems to point to some member of my household. And yet I cannot believe—" He broke off abruptly, then began again, his voice very grave. "Mr. Blunt, I must place myself in your hands unreservedly. I dare not go to the police in the matter. Of my three servants, I am almost entirely sure. They have served me long and faithfully. Still, one never knows. Then I have living with me my two nephews, Bertram and Henry. Henry is a good boy, a very good boy. He has never caused me any anxiety, an excellent, hard-working young fellow. Bertram, I regret to say, is of quite a different character. Wild, extravagant, and persistently idle."
"I see," said Tommy thoughtfully. "You suspect your nephew Bertram of being mixed up in this business?"
"Now, I don't agree with you. I suspect the good boy, Henry."
"But why?"
"Tradition. Precedent."
Tommy waved his hand airily. "In my experience, the suspicious characters are always innocent, and vice versa, my dear sir. Yes, decidedly, I suspect Henry."
"Excuse me, Mr. Blunt," said Tuppence, interrupting in a deferential tone. "Did I understand Dr. Bauer to say that these notes on, obscure alkaloids are kept in the desk with the other papers?"
"They are kept in the desk, my dear young lady,
but in a secret drawer, the position of which is known only to myself. Hence, they have so far defied the search.
And what exactly do you want me to do, Dr. Bauer? Asked Tommy. Do you anticipate that a further search will be made?
I do, Mr. Blunt. I have every reason to believe so. This afternoon I received a telegram from a patient of mine whom I ordered to Bournemouth a few weeks ago. The telegram states that my patient is in a critical condition and begs me to come down at once. Rendered suspicious by the events I have told you of, I myself dispatched a telegram, prepaid, to the patient in question, and elicited the fact that he was in good health and had sent no summons to me of any kind. It occurred to me that if I pretended to have been taken in and duly departed to Bournemouth, we should have a very good chance of finding the miscreants at work. They, or he, will doubtless wait until the household has retired to bed before commencing operations. I suggest that you should meet me outside my house at 11 o'clock this evening, and we will investigate the matter together. Hoping, in fact, to catch them in the act. Tommy drummed thoughtfully on the table with a paper knife. Your plan seems to me an excellent one, Dr. Bauer. I cannot see any hitch in it. Let me see. Your address is...
The Larches, Hangman's Lane. Rather a lonely part, I am afraid. But we command magnificent views over the heath.
Quite so, said Tommy.
The visitor rose. Then I shall expect you tonight, Mr. Blunt. Outside the Larches at, shall we say, 11:05, to be on the safe side?
Certainly, 11:05.
Good afternoon, Dr. Bauer.
Tommy rose, pressed a buzzer on his desk, and Albert appeared to show the client out. The doctor walked with a decided limp, but his powerful physique was evident in spite of it.
An ugly customer to tackle, murmured Tommy to himself. Well, Tuppence, old girl, what do you think of it?
I'll tell you in one word, said Tuppence. Clubfoot.
What?
I said, Clubfoot. My study of the classics has not been in vain. Tommy, this thing's a plant. Obscure alkaloids, indeed. I never heard a weaker story.
Even I did not find it very convincing, admitted her husband.
Did you see his eyes on the letter? Tommy, he's one of the gang. They've got wise to the fact that you're not the real Mr. Blunt, and they're out for our blood.
In that case, said Tommy, opening the side cupboard and surveying his rows of books with an affectionate eye, our role is easy to select. We are the brothers Oakwood, and I am Desmond, he added firmly.
Tuppence shrugged her shoulders. All right, have it your own way. I'd as soon be Francis. Francis was much the more intelligent of the two. Desmond always gets into a mess, and Francis turns up as the gardener or something in the nick of time and saves the situation.
Ah, said Tommy, but I shall be a super Desmond. When I arrive at the Larches...
Tuppence interrupted him unceremoniously. You're not going to Hampstead tonight.
Why not?
Walk into a trap with your eyes shut.
No, my dear girl, walk into a trap with my eyes open. There's a lot of difference. I think our friend Dr. Bauer will get a little surprised.
I don't like it, said Tuppence. You know what happens when Desmond disobeys the chief's orders and acts on his own.
Our orders were quite clear, to send on the letters at once, and to report immediately on anything that happened.
You've not got it quite right, said Tommy. We were to report immediately if anyone came in and mentioned the number 16.
Nobody has.
That's a quibble, said Tuppence.
It's no good. I've got a fancy for playing a lone hand, my dear old Tuppence. I shall be all right. I shall go armed to the teeth. The essence of the whole thing is that I shall be on my guard and they won't know it. The chief will be patting me on the back for a good night's work.
Well, said Tuppence, I don't like it. That man's as strong as a gorilla.
Ah, said Tommy, but think of my blue-nosed automatic.
The door of the outer office opened, and Albert appeared. Closing the door behind him, he approached them with an envelope in his hand.
A gentleman to see you, said Albert. When I began the usual stunt of saying you were engaged with Scotland Yard, he told me he knew all about that. Said he came from Scotland Yard himself, and he wrote something on a card and stuck it up in this envelope.
Tommy took the envelope and opened it. As he read the card, a grin passed across his face.
The gentleman was amusing himself at your expense by speaking the truth, Albert, he remarked.
Show him in.
He tossed the card to Tuppence. It bore the name Detective Inspector Dymchurch, and across it was scrawled in pencil, A Friend of Marriott's. In another minute, the Scotland Yard detective was entering the inner office. In appearance, Inspector Dymchurch was of the same type as Inspector Marriott, short and thick-set, with shrewd eyes.
Good afternoon, said the detective breezily. Marriott's away in South Wales, but before he went, he asked me to keep an eye on you two, and on this place in general.
Oh, bless you, sir, he went on as Tommy seemed about to interrupt him.
We know all about it.
It's not our department, and we don't interfere. But somebody's got wise lately to the fact that all is not what it seems. You've had a gentleman here this afternoon. I don't know what he called himself, and I don't know what his real name is, but I know just a little about him, enough to want to know more. Am I right in assuming that he made a date with you for some particular spot this evening?
Quite right.
I thought as much. 16 Westerham Road, Finsbury Park, was that it?
You're wrong there, said Tommy with a smile.
Dead wrong. The Larches, Hampstead.
Dymchurch seemed honestly taken aback. Clearly he had not expected this.
I don't understand it, he muttered. It must be a new layout.
The Larches, Hampstead, you said?
Yes, I'm to meet him there at 11 o'clock tonight.
Don't you do it, sir.
There, burst from Tuppence. Tommy flushed. If you think, Inspector, he began heatedly, but the inspector raised a soothing hand. I'll tell you what I think, Mr. Blunt. The place you want to be at 11 o'clock tonight is here in this office.
What? Cried Tuppence, astonished.
Here in this office. Never mind how I know. Departments overlap sometimes. But you got one of those famous blue letters today. Old what's-his-name is after that. He lures you up to Hampstead, makes quite sure of your being out of the way, and steps in here at night when all the building is empty and quiet to have a good search round at his leisure.
But why should he think the letter would be here? He'd know I should have it on me, or else have passed it on.
Begging your pardon, sir, that's just what he wouldn't know. He may have tumbled to the fact that you're not the original Mr. Blunt, but he probably thinks that you're a bona fide gentleman who's bought the business. In that case, the letter would be all in the way of regular business, and would be filed as such.
I see, said Tuppence.
And that's just what we've got to let him think. We'll catch him red-handed here tonight.
So that's the plan, is it?
Yes, it's the chance of a lifetime. Now, let me see, what's the time?
6 o'clock.
What time do you usually leave here, sir?
About 6.
You must seem to leave the place as usual. Actually, we'll sneak back to it as soon as possible. I don't believe they'll come here till about 11, but of course they might. If you'll excuse me, I'll just go and take a look around outside and see if I can make out anyone watching the place.
Dymchurch departed, and Tommy began an argument with Tuppence. It lasted some time and was heated and acrimonious. In the end, Tuppence suddenly capitulated.
All right, she said, I give in. I'll go home and sit there like a good little girl whilst you tackle crooks and hobnob with detectives. But you wait, young man. I'll be even with you yet for keeping me out of the fun.
Dymchurch returned at that moment.
Coast seems clear enough, he said, but you can't tell. Better seem to leave in the usual manner. They won't go on watching the place once you've gone.
Tommy called Albert and gave him instructions to lock up. Then the four of them made their way to the garage nearby where the car was usually left. Tuppence drove, and Albert sat beside her. Tommy and the detective sat behind. Presently, they were held up by a block in the traffic. Tuppence looked over her shoulder and nodded. Tommy and the detective opened the right-hand door and stepped out into the middle of Oxford Street. In a minute or two, Tuppence drove on.
Better not go in just yet, said Dymchurch, as he and Tommy hurried into Haylam Street. You've got the key all right?
Tommy nodded.
Then what about a bite of dinner? It's early, but there's a little place here right opposite. We'll get a table by the window so that we can watch the place all the time.
They had a very welcome little meal, in the manner the detective had suggested. Tommy found Inspector Dymchurch quite an entertaining companion. Most of his official work had lain amongst international spies, and he had tales to tell which astonished his simple listener. They remained in the little restaurant until 8 o'clock, when Dymchurch suggested a move.
It's quite dark now, sir, he explained. We shall be able to slip in without anyone being the wiser.
It was, as he said, quite dark. They crossed the road, looked quickly up and down the deserted street, and slipped inside the entrance. Then they mounted the stairs, and Tommy inserted his key in the lock of the outer office. Just as he did so, he heard, as he thought, Dymchurch whistle beside him. "What are you whistling for?" he asked sharply. "I didn't whistle," said Dymchurch, very much astonished. "I thought you did." "Well, someone," began Tommy. He got no further. Strong arms seized him from behind, and before he could cry out, a pad of something sweet and sickly was pressed over his mouth and nose. He struggled valiantly, but in vain. The chloroform did its work. His head began to whirl, and the floor heaved up and down in front of him. Choking, he lost consciousness. He came to himself painfully, but in full possession of his faculties. The chloroform had been only a whiff. They had kept him under long enough to force a gag into his mouth and ensure that he did not cry out. When he came to himself, he was half lying, half sitting, propped against the wall in a corner of his own inner office. Two men were busily turning out the contents of the desk and ransacking the cupboards, and as they worked, they cursed freely.
"So help me, Governor," said the taller of the two hoarsely. "We've turned the old blasted place upside down and inside out. It's not there."
"It must be here," snarled the other. "It isn't on him, and there's no other place it can be."
As he spoke, he turned, and to Tommy's utter amazement, he saw that the last speaker was none other than Inspector Dymchurch. The latter grinned when he saw Tommy's astonished face.
"So, our young friend is awake again," he said, "and a little surprised. Yes, a little surprised. But it was so simple. We suspect that all is not as it should be with the International Detective Agency. I volunteer to find out if that is so or not. If the new Mr. Blunt is indeed a spy, he will be suspicious. So I send first my dear old friend Carl Bauer. Carl is told to act suspiciously and pitch an improbable tale. He does so, and then I appear on the scene. I use the name of Inspector Marriott to gain confidence. The rest is easy." He laughed.
Tommy was dying to say several things, but the gag in his mouth prevented him. Also, he was dying to do several things, mostly with his hands and feet, but alas, that too had been attended to. He was securely bound. The thing that amazed him most was the astounding change in the man standing over him. As Inspector Dymchurch, the fellow had been a typical Englishman. Now, no one could have mistaken him for a moment for anything but a well-educated foreigner who talked English perfectly, without a trace of accent.
"Coggins, my good friend," said the erstwhile inspector, addressing his ruffianly-looking associate, "take your life preserver and stand by the prisoner. I'm going to remove the gag. You understand, my dear Mr. Blunt, do you not, that it would be criminally foolish on your part to cry out? But I'm sure you do. For your age, you're quite an intelligent lad."
Very deftly, he removed the gag and stepped back. Tommy eased his stiff jaws, rolled his tongue round his mouth, swallowed twice, and said nothing at all.
"I congratulate you on your restraint," said the other. "You appreciate the position, I see. Have you nothing at all to say?"
"What I have to say will keep," said Tommy, "and it won't spoil by waiting."
"Ah, what I have to say will not keep. In plain English, Mr. Blunt, where is that letter?"
"My dear fellow, I don't know," said Tommy cheerfully.
"I haven't got it. But you know that as well as I do. I should go on looking about if I were you. I like to see you and your friend Coggins playing hide-and-seek together."
The other's face darkened.
"You are pleased to be flippant, Mr. Blunt. You see that square box over there? That is Coggins's little outfit. In it there is vitriol, yes, vitriol, and irons that can be heated in the fire so that they are red hot and burn."
Tommy shook his head sadly.
"An error in diagnosis," he murmured. "Tuppence and I label this adventure wrong. It's not a clubfoot story. It's a bulldog Drummond. And you are the inimitable Carl Peterson." "What is this nonsense you are talking?" snarled the other.
"Ah," said Tommy, "I see you are unacquainted with the classics. A pity."
"Ignorant fool. Will you do what we want, or will you not? Shall I tell Coggins to get out his tools and begin?"
"Don't be so impatient," said Tommy. "Of course I'll do what you want, as soon as you tell me what it is. You don't suppose I want to be carved up like a filleted sole and fried on a gridiron?
I loathe being hurt.
Dymchurch looked at him in contempt.
God, what cowards are these English!
Common sense, my dear fellow, merely common sense. Leave the vitriol alone and let us come down to brass tacks.
I want the letter.
I've already told you, I haven't got it.
We know that. We also know who must have it. The girl.
Very possibly you're right, said Tommy. She may have slipped it into her handbag when your pal Carl startled us.
Oh, you do not deny. That is wise. Very good. You will write to this Tuppence, as you call her, bidding her bring the letter here immediately.
I can't do that, began Tommy. The other cut in before he had finished the sentence.
Ah, you can't. Well, we shall soon see. Coggins.
Don't be in such a hurry, said Tommy. And do wait for the end of the sentence. I was going to say that I can't do that unless you untie my arms. Hang it all, I'm not one of these freaks who can write with their noses or their elbows.
You are willing to write, then?
Of course. Haven't I been telling you so all along? I'm all out to be pleasant and obliging. You won't do anything unkind to Tuppence, of course. I'm sure you won't. She's such a nice girl.
We only want the letter, said Dymchurch.
But there was a singularly unpleasant smile on his face. At a nod from him, the brutal Coggins knelt down and unfastened Tommy's arms. The latter swung them to and fro.
Oh, that's better, he said cheerfully. Will kind Coggins hand me my fountain pen? It's on the table, I think, with my other miscellaneous property.
Scowling, the man brought it to him and provided a sheet of paper.
Be careful what you say, Dymchurch said menacingly. We leave it to you, but failure means death, and slow death at that.
In that case, said Tommy, I will certainly do my best. He reflected a minute or two, then began to scribble rapidly.
How will this do? He asked, handing over the completed epistle.
Dear Tuppence, can you come along at once and bring that blue letter with you? We want to decode it here and now. In haste, Francis.
Francis?
Queried the bogus inspector with lifted eyebrows.
Was that the name she called you?
As you weren't at my christening, said Tommy, I don't suppose you can know whether it's my name or not, but I think the cigarette case you took from my pocket is a pretty good proof that I'm speaking the truth. The other stepped over to the table and took up the case, read Francis from Tuppence, with a faint grin, and laid it down again.
I'm glad to find you are behaving so sensibly, he said. Coggins, give that note to Vasily. He is on guard outside. Tell him to take it at once.
The next 20 minutes passed slowly. The 10 minutes after that, more slowly still. Dymchurch was striding up and down with a face that grew darker and darker. Once he turned menacingly on Tommy.
If you have dared to double-cross us, he growled.
If we had a pack of cards here, we might have had a game of piquet to pass the time, drawled Tommy. Women always keep on waiting. I hope you're not going to be unkind to little Tuppence when she comes.
Oh, no, said Dymchurch. We shall arrange for you to go to the same place. Together.
Will you, you swine, said Tommy under his breath. Suddenly there was a stir in the outer office. A man whom Tommy had not yet seen poked his head in and growled something in Russian.
Good, said Dymchurch. She is coming, and coming alone.
For a moment a faint anxiety caught at Tommy's heart. The next minute he heard Tuppence's voice.
Oh, there you are, Inspector Dymchurch. I've brought the letter. Where is Francis?
With the last words she came through the door, and Vasily sprang on her from behind, clapping his hand over her mouth. Dymchurch tore the handbag from her grasp and turned over its contents in a frenzied search. Suddenly he uttered an ejaculation of delight and held up a blue envelope with a Russian stamp on it. Coggins gave a hoarse shout. And just in that minute of triumph, the other door, the door into Tuppence's own office, opened noiselessly, and Inspector Marriott and two men armed with revolvers stepped into the room with the sharp command,
"Hands up!"
There was no fight. The others were taken at a hopeless disadvantage. Dymchurch's automatic lay on the table, and the two others were not armed.
A very nice little haul, said Inspector Marriott with approval,
as he snapped the last pair of handcuffs.
And we'll have more as time goes on, I hope.
White with rage, Dymchurch glared at Tuppence.
You little devil, he snarled. It was you put them onto us.
Tuppence laughed.
It wasn't all my doing. I ought to have guessed, I admit, when you brought in the number 16 this afternoon.
But it was Tommy's note clinched matters. I rang up Inspector Marriott,
got Albert to meet him with the duplicate key of the office, and came along myself with the empty blue envelope in my bag. The letter I forwarded according to my instructions as soon as I had parted with you two this afternoon. But one word had caught the other's attention.
Tommy?
He queried. Tommy, who had just been released from his bonds, came towards them.
Well done, Brother Francis, he said to Tuppence, taking both her hands in his, and to Dymchurch. As I told you, my dear fellow, you really ought to read the classics.
Chapter 5 Finessing the King. It was a wet Wednesday in the offices of the International Detective Agency. Tuppence let the Daily Leader fall idly from her hand.
Do you know what I've been thinking, Tommy?
It's impossible to say, replied her husband. You think of so many things, and you think of them all at once.
I think it's time we went dancing again.
Tommy picked up the Daily Leader hastily.
Our advertisement looks well, he remarked, his head on one side. Blunt's Brilliant Detectives.
Do you realize, Tuppence, that you, and you alone, are Blunt's Brilliant Detectives?
There's glory for you, as Humpty Dumpty would say.
I was talking about dancing.
There's a curious point that I have observed about newspapers. I wonder if you've ever noticed it. Take these three copies of the Daily Leader. Can you tell me how they differ, one from the other?
Tuppence took them with some curiosity.
Seems fairly easy, she remarked witheringly. One is today's, one is yesterday's, and one is the day before's.
Positively scintillating, my dear Watson, but that was not my meaning. Observe the headline, Daily Leader. Compare the three. Do you see any difference between them?
No, I don't, said Tuppence, and what's more, I don't believe there is any.
Tommy sighed and brought the tips of his fingers together in the most approved Sherlock Holmes fashion.
Exactly. Yet you read the papers as much, in fact more, than I do. But I have observed, and you have not. If you will look at today's Daily Leader, you will see that in the middle of the downstroke of the D is a small white dot. And there is another in the L of the same word. But in yesterday's paper, the white dot is not in Daily at all. There are two white dots in the L of Leader. That of the day before again has two dots in the D of Daily. In fact, the dot, or dots, are in a different position every day.
Why? Asked Tuppence.
That's a journalistic secret.
Meaning you don't know and can't guess.
I will merely say this, the practice is common to all newspapers.
Aren't you clever? Said Tuppence.
Especially as drawing red herrings across the track. Let's go back to what we were talking about before.
What were we talking about?
The Three Arts Ball.
Tommy groaned.
No, no, Tuppence, not the Three Arts Ball. I'm not young enough. I assure you, I'm not young enough.
When I was a nice young girl, said Tuppence, I was brought up to believe that men, especially husbands, were dissipated beings fond of drinking and dancing and staying up late at night. It took an exceptionally beautiful and clever wife to keep them at home. Another illusion gone. All the wives I know are hankering to go out and dance and weeping because their husbands will wear bedroom slippers and go to bed at 9:30. And you do dance so nicely, Tommy, dear.
Gently with the butter, Tuppence.
As a matter of fact, said Tuppence, it's not purely for pleasure that I want to go. I'm intrigued by this advertisement.
She picked up the Daily Leader again and read it out.
I should go 3 hearts, 12 tricks, ace of spades, necessary to finesse the king.
Rather an expensive way of learning bridge, was Tommy's comment.
Don't be an ass. That's nothing to do with bridge. You see, I was lunching with a girl yesterday at the Ace of Spades. It's a queer little underground den in Chelsea, and she told me that it's quite the fashion at these big shows to trundle round there in the course of the evening for bacon and eggs and Welsh rarebits. Bohemian sort of stuff. It's got screened-off booths all round it. Pretty hot place, I should say.
And your idea is 3 hearts stands for the Arts Ball tomorrow night. 12 tricks is 12 o'clock. And the Ace of Spades is the Ace of Spades.
And what about its being necessary to finesse the king?
Well, that's what I thought we'd find out.
I shouldn't wonder if you weren't right, Tuppence, said Tommy magnanimously. But I don't quite see why you want to butt in upon other people's love affairs.
I shan't butt in.
What I'm proposing is an interesting experiment in detective work. We need practice.
Business is certainly not too brisk, agreed Tommy.
All the same, Tuppence, what you want is to go to the Three Arts Ball and dance. Talk of red herrings. Tuppence laughed shamelessly. Oh, be a sport, Tommy. Try and forget you're 32 and have got one grey hair in your left eyebrow.
I was always weak where women were concerned, murmured her husband. Have I got to make an ass of myself in fancy dress?
Of course, but you can leave that to me. I've got a splendid idea. Tommy looked at her with some misgiving. He was always profoundly mistrustful of Tuppence's brilliant ideas. When he returned to the flat on the following evening, Tuppence came flying out of her bedroom to meet him.
It's come, she announced.
What's come?
The costume. Come and look at it.
Tommy followed her. Spread out on the bed was a complete fireman's kit with shining helmet.
Good God, groaned Tommy.
Have I joined the Wembley Fire Brigade?
Guess again, said Tuppence. You haven't caught the idea yet. Use your little grey cells, mon ami. Scintillate, Watson. Be a bull that has been more than 10 minutes in the arena.
Wait a minute, said Tommy. I begin to see. There is a dark purpose in this. What are you going to wear, Tuppence?
An old suit of your clothes, an American hat, and some horn spectacles.
Crude, said Tommy, but I catch the idea. McCarty, incog, and I'm Reardon.
That's it. I thought we ought to practice American detective methods as well as English ones. Just for once, I'm going to be the star, and you will be the humble assistant.
Don't forget, said Tommy warningly, that it's always an innocent remark by the simple Denny that puts McCarty on the right track. But Tuppence only laughed. She was in high spirits. It was a most successful evening. The crowds, the music, the fantastic dresses, everything conspired to make the young couple enjoy themselves. Tommy forgot his role of the bored husband dragged out against his will. At 11:50, they drove off in the car to the famous, or infamous, Ace of Spades. As Tuppence had said, it was an underground den, mean and tawdry in appearance, but it was nevertheless crowded with couples in fancy dress. There were closed-in booths round the walls, and Tommy and Tuppence secured one of these. They left the doors purposely a little ajar, so that they could see what was going on outside.
I wonder which they are. Our people, I mean, said Tuppence. What about that Columbine over there, with the red Mephistopheles?
I fancy the wicked Mandarin, and the lady who calls herself a battleship. More of a fast cruiser, I should say.
Isn't he witty, said Tuppence.
All done on a little drop of drink.
Who's this coming in dressed as the Queen of Hearts? Rather a good get-up, that.
The girl in question passed into the booth next to them, accompanied by her escort, who was the gentleman dressed in newspaper from Alice in Wonderland. They were both wearing masks. It seemed to be rather a common custom at the Ace of Spades.
I'm sure we're in a real den of iniquity, said Tuppence with a pleased face. Scandals all round us. What a row everyone makes.
A cry, as of protest, rang out from the booth next door and was covered by a man's loud laugh. Everybody was laughing and singing. The shrill voices of the girls rose above the booming of their male escorts.
What about that shepherdess? Demanded Tommy.
The one with the comic Frenchman.
They might be our little lot.
Anyone might be, confessed Tuppence. I'm not going to bother. The great thing is that we're enjoying ourselves.
I could have enjoyed myself better in another costume, grumbled Tommy. You've no idea of the heat of this one.
Cheer up, said Tuppence. You look lovely.
I'm glad of that, said Tommy. It's more than you do. You're the funniest little guy I've ever seen.
Will you keep a civil tongue in your head, Denny?
Hello. The gentleman in newspaper is leaving his lady alone.
Where's he going, do you think?
Going to hurry up the drinks, I expect, said Tommy. I wouldn't mind doing the same thing.
He's a long time doing it, said Tuppence, when 4 or 5 minutes had passed.
Tommy, would you think me an awful ass?
She paused.
Suddenly she jumped up.
Call me an ass if you like. I'm going in next door.
Look here, Tuppence, you can't. I've a feeling there's something wrong.
I know there is. Don't try and stop me. She passed quickly out of their own booth, and Tommy followed her. The doors of the one next door were closed. Tuppence pushed them apart and went in, Tommy on her heels. The girl, dressed as the Queen of Hearts, sat in the corner, leaning up against the wall in a queer, huddled position. Her eyes regarded them steadily through her mask, but she did not move. Her dress was carried out in a bold design of red and white, but on the left-hand side the pattern seemed to have got mixed. There was more red than there should have been. With a cry, Tuppence hurried forward. At the same time, Tommy saw what she had seen, the hilt of a jeweled dagger just below the heart. Tuppence dropped on her knees by the girl's side. "Quick, Tommy! She's still alive! Get hold of the manager and make him get a doctor at once!" "Right. Mind you don't touch the handle of that dagger, Tuppence. I'll be careful. Go quickly!" Tommy hurried out, pulling the doors to behind him. Tuppence passed her arm round the girl. The latter made a faint gesture, and Tuppence realized that she wanted to get rid of the mask. Tuppence unfastened it gently. She saw a fresh, flower-like face and wide, starry eyes that were full of horror, suffering, and a kind of dazed bewilderment. "My dear," said Tuppence very gently, "can you speak at all? Will you tell me, if you can, who did this?" She felt the eyes fix themselves on her face. The girl was sighing, the deep, palpitating sighs of a failing heart. And still she looked steadily at Tuppence. Then her lips parted.
"Bingo did it,"
she said in a strained whisper. Then her hands relaxed, and she seemed to nestle down on Tuppence's shoulder. Tommy came in, two men with him. The bigger of the two came forward with an air of authority, the word "doctor" written all over him. Tuppence relinquished her burden. "She's dead, I'm afraid," she said with a catch in her voice. The doctor made a swift examination.
"Yes," he said. "Nothing to be done. We had better leave things as they are till the police come."
"How did the thing happen?" Tuppence explained rather haltingly, slurring over her reasons for entering the booth.
"It's a curious business," said the doctor. "You heard nothing?"
"I heard her give a kind of cry, but then the man laughed. Naturally, I didn't think—"
"Naturally not," agreed the doctor. "And the man wore a mask, you say? You wouldn't recognize him?"
"I'm afraid not. Would you, Tommy?"
"No. Still, there is his costume." "The first thing will be to identify this poor lady," said the doctor. "After that, well, I suppose the police will get down to things pretty quickly. It ought not to be a difficult case. Ah, here they come."